show and the variety of stuff you get to cover. Talking of which, the science of with Chris Smith coming up in the next hour, including the woman who's brought the 2,000-year-old seed kind of sort of back to life to make a tree. It's just gone up to 1 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the 5 Live News, good afternoon, I'm Nick Hatfield. The Israeli military and the Hezbollah group in Lebanon have continued cross-border attacks against each other. Hezbollah says it's targeted military sites in northern Israel. A Lebanese health minister says 558 people were killed and more than 1,800 wounded in yesterday's Israeli airstrikes. Shashank Joshi, the defence editor at The Economist, told 5 Live there are concerns in Israel that the military is being stretched.
There is a tension, I think, within the Israeli establishment about how much further to go, because precisely for the reason you mentioned, they don't want a full-fledged two-front war. They need to recover their reservists. They need to rest them. They need to rebuild ammunition stocks. There are some in the IDF who say we need to go slowly and wait. I think the political leadership has really been pushing for this.
Keir Starmer is preparing to make his first speech to the Labour conference as Prime Minister. He's expected to highlight tough choices ahead while promising a light at the end of the tunnel. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth is in Liverpool and says it's been a tricky few weeks for the PM.
It hasn't been the smoothest backdrop because, of course, we had all those stories about freebies and the criticism around that and briefings about what's going on with the pay of some senior people in Downing Street, and then that really contentious issue of the winter fuel payment. But to be honest, I do think people are looking ahead to the Prime Minister's speech. The queues, I suspect, are going to start building. But as well as the tone that he strikes, I think a lot of people are going to be looking for detail too about what exactly it is this government's going to do.
Well, in her speech at the conference, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, promised to halve knife crime in a decade and open new youth clubs. Figures show a large rise in the number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police. They seized more than 900 e-bikes in the last year. That's up from 511 the previous 12 months. Ash Medforth's daughter was hit by an electric scooter and he set up the campaign, "Just Stick a Reg on It." He told 5 Live modifying an e-bike can be dangerous.
They don't want to pay the road tax insurance and they basically get a free pass to have a moped without any of that. And they also don't have to pay petrol on it or anything like that because they just charge them up and that then go. Many of them are very unsafe and actually set on fire as well because these kits are not the best quality.
And TSB customers have reported problems with payments, with some saying they haven't received salaries or their child benefit. The bank has apologised and says it's working to fix an IT issue. Let's get the sports news now. Here's Jonathan McKeith.
Thank you. We'll start in Durham and the third ODI between England and Australia. The home side won the toss and are having a bowl. Ellie Aldroyd has the latest.
Are 26 for one after seven overs here, so England have done pretty well to restrict them in these opening overs of the power play, and they've also taken the crucial wicket of Matthew Short, who was caught on the boundary, deep square leg boundary by Adil Rashid off the bowling of Jofra Archer. He was out for 14. Mitch Marsh is on 8, Steve Smith is on 1, and Jofra Archer bowling from the Lumley end here at Chester Street, Australia, 26 for one in the 8th.
Commentary on 5 Sports Extra. Arsenal's Mikel Arteta has hinted that one of his players has picked up a serious injury in Sunday's Premier League draw at Manchester City. He wouldn't be drawn on which individual, but says we'll find out when he names the team for tomorrow's third round EFL Cup tie at home to Bolton. And a knee injury to New Zealand centre Jordy Barrett could see him miss the start of the All Blacks tour of the Northern Hemisphere. They are set to play England on the 2nd of November before matches against Ireland, France and Italy on the following 3 weekends.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We feel totally betrayed.
Welcome to Murrayfield.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Adrian Childs. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just coming up to 1:05. In around an hour's time, we'll be into the start of the Prime Minister's speech to Labour conference, the first from a Labour Prime Minister to conference in a good many years now. Matt Chorley will be taking us there. First, though, the luxury department store Harrods is investigating whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohammed Al-Fayed. Harrods says an internal review started last year and that it is in direct communication with the Metropolitan Police. Bruce Drummond is from the barrister team Justice for Harrods Survivors. So where are we at with these complaints?
Good afternoon, Adrian. We are currently now in the process of retaining some 150 ladies that have made inquiries to date. And obviously, you can imagine that's quite a long task to do because we have to, you know, speak to all the inquiries and the ladies and make sure that they're happy and content to move forward. As far as the where we are in the status, I think that the first thing that we're concerned about is the position with Harrods and their recent statement that, you know, whilst they are wholly accepting responsibility for what happened to these ladies, which was horrific, by the way, the parts that concern us is that they're saying, well, come to us. We have our own complaints procedure. And so that has caused concern because a lot of the ladies that we've spoken to and act for have said they've found that most disturbing. Firstly, because it's effectively like marking your own homework, and they are not an independent source, even though they've said they've instructed independent counsel. But also...
Well, can I just say on that, they are kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't, aren't they? Yeah, because if they had no such operation in play, then they would be criticised for that. And just from their statement, they're just saying as part of their due diligence, there's an ongoing internal review supported by external counsel, which I assume is somebody like yourself, a barrister.
Sure.
Including looking at whether any current staff were involved directly or indirectly, and
that's great.
Looking at further issues, also in direct communication with the Metropolitan Police. So,
yeah.
Okay, so, it's open season on Harrods to an extent, but that, what more can they do?
You've got to put it into perspective. This is one of the worst cases of corporate exploitation of young women that the world has ever seen. It's a massive scale abuse. And I think that in their way they've responded, I think the concern is that they've just focused on, yes, come to us, you can make a claim effectively for compensation and we'll assess it, or we've got independent people to assess it, which to a lot of the ladies seems quite disturbing.
Well, so how do you want to, how should it work then?
I'll tell you, because what's happened is that they feel that, they're saying that they're all about the money. That's how they feel, is they're saying, you know, if they'd said in response, you know, we accept responsibility, come to us to discuss what's happened, with the focus being on anything. It could be that in many cases they need further psychiatric help, they need therapy, they need somebody to listen and understand what's gone on. And yes, compensation would be a factor, but not the only factor.
Okay, so you're saying what they're talking about is too much about money and not about getting to the bottom of it. Is that your...
Exactly. And so that's why they felt, and they've explained to us, that they feel that, you know, well, all they're saying is that this is all about the money. And I can tell you, quite frankly, in over 50 calls I've made now, Not one lady has ever asked me, what do you think my claim would be worth? And to me, that says an awful lot.
Okay, so, but how can they get to the bottom of what's happened without speaking to the women involved? And the number seems to be growing all the time. So, it's just you're saying it's the tenor of the way the meetings and the exchanges are being conducted.
The system that was there, the way they're focusing purely on, you know, compensation and their claims to be assessed, which in many ways is a bit like marking your own homework.
Okay.
And I think that's the big concern. Okay, that is the major concern for the ladies we are acting
but
for.
But in terms of marking their own homework, since you put it like that, we should point out, in a way, it's marking somebody else's homework in a sense, because the Harrods, you know, Harrods is now has different owners, as they've said. The Harrods of today is a very different organisation to the one owned and controlled by Al-Fayed between 85 and 2010. But it is, isn't
it? That's right. Well, it's only got different owners. It's not a different organisation. And in fact, the managing director of Harrods currently was the managing director during the period that all this took place. So we have to question when they say, you know, it's a different organisation, because it isn't.
Okay.
It's the same place.
I'm confused about what this would look, how this whole process should now look in your view in an ideal world. So there's the internal review, which it's been ongoing since before the documentary by Harrods. You'd want that to go ahead with the support of external counsel and want them to be talking to Metropolitan Police. Okay, so you support that. What is the bit you don't support, or the bit you want to happen in addition to what is happening?
Sorry, could you say that again? I missed that.
So what is it you want to happen in addition to that, which isn't happening?
I think what we would like to see with them is a process for supporting the ladies, for accepting the responsibility for the ladies, for ensuring, and more so, that the Harrods of today is a very different operation to the Harrods in the past. And I think one of the problems they have there is that there are a number of senior staff members who are exactly the same and in exactly the same positions. And we're also getting comments from new inquiries coming in that they've been, so even after this regime, some of the treatment was terrible.
Okay. Well, okay. We haven't got a statement. The Harrods aren't here to defend themselves.
It just
feel like it needs a different, it feels like you're saying it needs a different kind of forum, a different kind of means, some kind of, independent inquiry. Is that what you're calling here?
I read in the, I think it was the Mail the other day, that there are a number of senior politicians saying this needs a public inquiry, something independent. Because the whole point of this is that these ladies want to see justice. And when they were asked what that means, they say, first of all, accountability, which I have to thank you and all the press involved in this for helping them to get that. It's the first time they felt comfortable and not threatened to be able to speak out. And so that's the first leg. And the second leg is to hope to make a change to the world in the way that these powerful companies behave.
Okay. How many more women have come forward since that program was put out?
We have 150, roughly. I can't tell you an exact figure, obviously, because they every day. I don't know if you heard my phone pinging while it's going on. It's new inquiries, and so it's growing exponentially.
Okay, all right. Thanks. Thanks very much for your time, Sir Bruce Drummond
help with these ladies.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, Mr. Drummond from the barrister team from Justice for Harrods Survivors. and this statement from Harrods, well, I've been through most of what they've said, but they are stressing that the settlement process was designed in consultation with independent external counsel and experts in personal injury litigation. All claims settled to date and moving forwards will be based on the guidance of these external individuals to ensure swift and impartial outcomes for the victims. As part of our due diligence, there's an ongoing internal review supported by external counsel, including looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations, either directly or indirectly. In addition, the Harrods board has established a non-executive committee of the board to further consider the issues arising from the allegations. Harrods is also in direct communication with the Metropolitan Police to ensure we are offering our assistance with any of their relevant inquiries. And previously, we should say, Harrods have said they're utterly appalled by the allegations of abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed. So these were the actions of an individual who was intent on abusing his power wherever he operated, and we condemn them in the strongest terms. We also acknowledge that during this time as a business, we failed our employees who were his victims, and for this we sincerely apologise. And they point out again, this is a different organisation to the one owned by Al-Fayed between 1985 and 2010. It's one that seeks to put the welfare of our employees at the heart of everything we do. It's just gone quarter past one, so let's get into the science of it's the science of just about everything, isn't it? Every week we talk through some of the most interesting science stories around with Dr. Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist. Plenty for you today. Where should we start? What about the COVID flu vaccine rollout? How are you doing, Chris? I just thought it's probably worth doing this because I get the sense we've slightly got complacent. COVID's behind us. Let's not worry about vaccines so much anymore when we all should.
Hello, Adrian. Well, next week is the rollout of the autumn booster programme. This is where we start to administer COVID boosters for people who are on the list. And there's a specific list of people who are on that list. There's also the flu vaccine rollout, and that's going to be combined with the COVID jab. So as we found out over the pandemic, we can get very good responses to both vaccines, and it's more efficient because we're giving both at once. And one more vaccine to bring to the party this year. We'll also have, for the over 75s, an RSV vaccine. This is respiratory syncytial virus, which causes big problems for very young people and also much older people, which is why with this vaccine we now have, they're targeting the over 75 age group this year, because we know it brings people into hospital. And so we're hoping to protect people and keep them out of hospital across the winter with that. And that too will be part of this rollout next week.
So the flu vaccine, that is slightly different every year, isn't it? What's the process by which it's sort of put together?
Well, what we do with flu is the World Health Organization has a network of literally thousands of laboratories around the world. They collect samples of the flu that are circulating in their particular geography. And flu tends to arrive in any given part of the world in that part of the world's winter time. So those laboratories will collect samples of their circulating flu. They share those samples with a network of 7 core laboratories, which are, there's one in the UK, in America, Japan, Australia. And those laboratories will compare, both between themselves and internally, the samples of flu that they're getting from their local network of laboratories with what we put into the vaccine. And they will test to see, does the vaccine we're using protect against these circulating strains? And because flu continuously mutates or varies in the same way that we saw with the coronavirus outbreak, we saw variants emerging. The flu does exactly the same thing. And so it slowly drifts or changes over the year, and eventually it will drift off target from the vaccine. And this network of laboratories will pick that up, and they will then make a decision collectively whether to adjust or update the vaccines for that year. And flu doesn't just come in one form. there are multiple forms of the flu. There's flu A and flu B, and flu A comes in two different flavours as well. So the vaccine actually ends up carrying three or four different types of flu, and they will make a vaccine which represents, based on those four types, what we think is likely to be coming our way in the opposite hemisphere in our winter. So it's a bit of guesswork, and that means that sometimes it doesn't work as well as other times, but on average it works about 60 to 70% of the time. They get a hit, and when we make that vaccine, it goes into people and it will give them protection for that particular winter. But because the flu continues to change, come the next winter, we're going to have to start the whole process all over again.
In terms of COVID, which is the variant doing the rounds at the moment, and what should and shouldn't you do when you get it?
Well, the interesting thing with COVID, we got quite familiar with this thing changing, and we were working our way through the Greek alphabet, if you remember. And then from about 2021, it centred on this Omicron variant. And since then, it's stopped changing into very dramatic different forms of coronavirus. It's centred on Omicron, and all of the variants we now see are spin-offs of that main thing. It's a bit like someone's come along and chopped a tree off at the trunk, and it's now sent all these sprouts out, but they're sprouts from one particular branch, and that's the Omicron branch.
So why is that happening, and what's the implications of that happening for us?
Well, we think that the way that viruses evolve, when you have a new virus in a population — this was a new virus, this SARS-CoV-2 that causes COVID-19 was a brand new virus. It had never circulated in humans in a widespread scale way before, and that's when the pandemic occurred, and that's why we all caught it, because no one had any immunity to it. So it emerged for the first time in humans, and the virus was almost certainly of some kind of wild animal original origin. Whether it came through a laboratory en route to us is still open to debate, but basically it was not well adapted to humans. And whenever you put a virus into a new population or a new host, there's a kind of a shakedown. The virus has to change in order to become a better bedfellow with its host, and its host may in some cases change in order to accommodate the virus better. You lose some people from the population, what remains is a fitter population and a virus that's better at spreading in that population. So there's a kind of an adaptive process. And what we think the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19 has done has settled on a particular makeup of the virus that coexists with us as efficiently as it can, so it can keep spreading. It doesn't make us too ill, so we leave it alone, and it doesn't rule itself out by killing us off. And in that way, it can sit alongside us and spread as efficiently as possible. So we think that's why it's arrived at this particular pattern of mutations that delineate the Omicron branch of the tree. And it still continues to change a little bit, but not in a dramatic way like it did before.
So you and I talked a lot during the lockdown, during the pandemic, and I wonder if, looking back now — I'm not asking you to criticise anyone or anything, or any particular policy — but with the benefit of hindsight, what did we generally get right, and what might we have got wrong that we wouldn't do if something similar came round again?
Well, a lot of people are now looking at what's surfacing from the COVID inquiry, for example, and a number of the practices that we put in place. In retrospect, probably we could have done without doing those things. We're seeing a lot of news surfacing at the moment about the social effects of lockdowns, for example. Pretty quickly during the pandemic, it emerged that young people were at much lower risk than older people. People with pre-existing health conditions were at much higher risk than the general population. What we probably should have done in retrospect was to focus more on those people and keeping those people at risk more safe, and allowing the general population to carry on business as usual.
Okay, so we're probably a bit too aggressive. A bit too aggressive. That's in terms right. of closing schools and, I don't know, and all the other stuff, pubs and
well, the economic fallout, that's right. And but certainly for young people, we are seeing a strong legacy effect of those lockdowns. I interviewed a lady called Susan Byrne, and she's been in the media again recently. One of the things that she did was to look at young babies that were lockdown babies and look at their social development. And she found evidence that they were a bit behind in some respects. They're now looking again to see whether they've caught up. And in some respects, they're still knock-on consequences in terms of social behaviour and that kind of thing. School teachers are anecdotally saying to me that some of the kids that were little when COVID first came, they are still behind socially in their lessons and don't behave in quite the same way. So there are definitely consequences, especially for young people. And I talked to a researcher in America last week. We'll perhaps talk about this a bit more later. And she was scanning teenagers' brains both before but during and after the pandemic, and they found that there was a profound aging effect on the brains of teenagers. Now, not because they caught the virus, but because of, they think, the social deprivation that went with the control efforts to get on top of the virus.
But the control
efforts is particularly prominent in young girls.
But it's always going to be difficult in public health doing anything which doesn't preserve life in the short term. Because if you were saying, well, we're going to open the schools so young people can go to schools, even if, you know, they live with older people and they'll bring the virus home, you know, it's... Even if that does result in more deaths in the short term amongst the vulnerable population, looked in the round and holistically, it's the right thing to do because of the long-term psychological damage for teenagers and so on. I mean, that's a big call to make and politically almost impossible, I would have thought.
Most people agree that the first lockdown was probably not an unreasonable response to an unknown entity, because we didn't know what we were dealing with. We didn't know how it was spreading. We had a vague idea, but we didn't know. For instance, it was a real revelation when the Office for National Statistics survey showed that maybe half the people who were asymptomatic were infected. And so as a result of that, it's not unreasonable to put in place strong control measures in the first instance while you learn, buy yourself time and slow down the pace of spread of the agent. But once we had a clearer measure of what this thing was, who it was really a problem for, and therefore who we really needed to try to protect the most and who had less to worry about, that's where we should probably have shifted the emphasis. And with the benefit of hindsight, the emphasis should have shifted towards let's keep the most vulnerable as safe as possible. And there are various ways to do that. Some people were urged to shield, for example. We could have made their lives easier doing that and put certain people into that category who weren't. But we could have allowed younger people to carry on business as usual, because they probably would have had very little to lose if they, well, we know they had very little to lose if they caught the infection. So I think most people agree that the initial lockdown response is not an unreasonable manoeuvre because it buys you time. But later, once you do learn and you do begin to get the measure of what the threat is, you can be prepared to change your approach and adjust accordingly.
So, should we get a COVID vaccine? I forgot where this is where we started at. Should everyone go out and get one now?
Well, you can buy one, of course, now. But the people who are on the list for those regarded as most vulnerable are those at the extremes of age, so over the age of 65, people who are more than 6 months and up to 65 who are at risk because they have some kind of chronic disease, such as heart disease, a kidney problem, or a problem with their immune system. And also people who are caring for people in those contexts, because we know that although the vaccine won't prevent you from getting the infection, it will stop you getting it for a while, and it will also cut down your likelihood of becoming symptomatic, so you're more able to look after people. So those are the people who are being advised to get the COVID vaccine, but certainly no one at the moment is being told you have to have the vaccine.
Okay, but is there any downside to having it? You say you can buy it, how much does it cost?
I think the downside is the thing. The cost is the downside.
Yeah.
And it's not cheap. I think we're talking about £100. So this is something that people would have to think very carefully about if they wanted to go and do that.
Mpox, what do we need to know about that?
Well, Mpox is the disease caused by the monkeypox virus, which is actually a member of the pox virus family, and it's a close relative of smallpox. And it was first detected in certain parts of Africa about 50 or 60 years ago, and it largely caused few problems for countries like ours. The only times we saw this was when there had been people who had been to the endemic geography, either Central Africa, where one form of the virus exists, or West Africa, where a close relative exists, and they brought the infection home with them, usually there were very few onward cases or no onward cases. It's not that infectious and it's not that severe in healthy people. So most of the time it was regarded as relatively trivial. Now, all this changed a couple of years ago when all of a sudden we saw a big surge in cases, and we saw this happening in one particular community. This is in the gay community, and we saw thousands of cases abruptly, and they were all caused by one particular form of the virus called clade 2b, which is the West African form of the virus. This galvanised action in many countries around the world that started to see this, because clearly this virus was emerging and exploiting a particular group of people and spreading through close personal contact with those people. And as a result, we had to move very quickly with vaccines and other things to try to stop the outbreak, which we successfully did. And everyone said, phew, let's breathe a sigh of relief. And then from about December last year, we've seen a really big head of steam build up again, this time in Central Africa, with a slightly different form of the virus. This one's called clade 1b, which is also spreading in sexual networks, but not exclusively in amongst gay people, but in broader groups of people, older people, younger people, but all centred on the Central African Republic and Democratic Republic of Congo and neighbouring countries. And why this has now become a more prominent news agenda item is that large numbers of people started to get it, and large numbers of people in the neighbouring countries started to get it, showing the virus is on the move. And so the WHO declared a public health emergency of international concern, which is basically a step down from a pandemic, saying this is something we have to be worried about. This is something that could take off if given the opportunity. Now's the time to intervene meaningfully and stop it before it becomes a problem. So they were really kind of sounding the alarm, shot over our bows, be on your guard. But at the moment, cases have remained low or very low in the majority of countries other than those on the African continent.
But now we've had a 38-year-old man from Kerala who's just returned from Dubai, reportedly has been carrying it.
Yes, and again, these are returning travellers. There's a travel history there. What we haven't got is endemicisation or spread in the community in other countries outside the African continent. This virus is naturally carried by small animals. We think rodents in parts of Africa where it lives, and people who go into those geographies pick it up, and then it gets into humans, causes a human cycle, and people who interact with infected humans in those geographies can bring it back with them, which is what has happened, we think, in all of the cases so far in countries where there have been declared cases outside the African continent. That we know there's a risk it could begin to spread in our country because of what happened 2 years ago with the other form that was spreading through sexual networks. And so that's why people are alarmed, and that's why the minute we see a case, we take steps to identify who's got it, who have they been with, where have they been, and therefore intervene with infection control measures to stop an outbreak.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll speak more, Dr. Chris, on the other side of the news and sport. It's just gone 1:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And with the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Dan Maudsley. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer is getting ready for his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister, in which he'll talk of light at the end of the tunnel, but he'll also warn of a shared struggle as the government tries to tackle a £22 billion shortfall in public finances. Well, earlier, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told the conference in Liverpool that the Labour government will halve knife crime in a decade. A ban on zombie-style knives and machetes has come into force in England and Wales today. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, is expected to chair an emergency COBRA meeting in London amid rising tensions in the Middle East. The Israeli military and Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon have continued cross-border attacks today, with Lebanon's health ministry saying more than 550 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. And TSB says it's trying to fix a problem after customers reported payment issues. Some haven't received their child benefit or salaries. Jonathan McKeith has the sport.
Thank you. England must win today's one-day international against Australia to keep the five-match series alive. They trail 2-0. Eleanor Aldroyd is watching at Chesterfield Street, and the home side have a second wicket, Ellie.
Yes, Australia 56 for 2 in the 14th over, and England have done really well stifling the Australian desire to score runs. In both cases, both wickets have fallen immediately after a six has been hit. Matthew Short caught on the boundary off the bowling of Jofra Archer for 14. And then Mitch Marsh caught behind by Jamie Smith off the bowling of Bryden Cast, one of two local seamers bowling here at Chesterfield Street. Marsh out for 24, and Steve Smith and Cameron Green currently out in the middle together. Green will get a couple there, take Australia on to 58 for 2 in the 14th over. But yeah, it's a bright start for England, restricting the run rate to just over 4 and over for Australia.
Elliot, for now, thank you. Commentary continues on Five Sports Extra. Also in cricket, the nominees for the Men's and Women's Cricketers of the Year have been announced by the Professional Cricketers Association. Gus Atkinson, Liam Dawson, Colin Ingram and Joe Root are up for the Men's Prize. Holly Armitage, Catherine Bryce, Paige Schofield and Nat Siver-Brunt are nominated for the Women's Award. Arsenal's Mikel Arteta has refused to dwell on Sunday's eventful 2-2 draw with Manchester City. His side were accused of time-wasting after Leandro Trossard's first half sending off. Arteta says his team's response to simply defend was normal, especially having previously been in a similar situation at the Etihad.
We learn from the past as well, because unfortunately we've been in that situation with them three times very recently. One it was with Granit after 38 minutes it was. And we consider how many. So, we better learn. If not, we'll be very thick.
Arsenal lost that day 5-0 3 years ago. Tonight, attention switches to the EFL Cup. Five Live Sport will have third-round commentary of Wickham at home to Aston Villa. Fat Sports Extra has Walsall Leicester. We also have updates from Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea host League Two leaders Barrow. Here's their manager, Stephen Clements.
We're talking about proper world-class footballers here, and we're under no illusions it will be difficult. But saying that, we're going into a game of football, it's 11v11, anything can happen. And obviously, if you can get through 90 minutes, there's a penalty shootout, there's no extra time, you just never know in this game. So we'll go there and we'll give it our best shot.
Britain's Fran Brown has defended her C1 individual time trial title at the Road Paracycling World Championships in Zurich. And the New Zealand centre, Jordy Barrett, has injured his knee and could be a doubt for the start of the All Blacks tour of the Northern Hemisphere. They're set to play England on the 2nd of November before matches against Ireland, France and Italy on the following three weekends. For now, though, that's your latest from BBC Sport.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, Central State of Culture Media as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley,
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC Radio 5 Live,
the voice of the UK.
On digital radio,
on BBC Sounds,
and ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Adrian Childs,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Smith, who's telling us about the science of everything. The science of what happens to women's brains, sort of physically, I think we mean, don't we, in pregnancy, Chris. There's some new research here.
A brilliant study. Laura Pritchett, who's a researcher over in America, and her colleagues, decided that they would do the study that everyone had been waiting for, which is to actually serially scan a lady who was wanting to get pregnant, got pregnant, and then had her baby with an MRI scan, so that they could monitor changes to her brain, if any, over the course of that process. Because people had in the past done studies on women who wanted to get pregnant, scanned their brains, waited for them to have a baby and scanned their brain in the aftermath and said, well, there appears to be a difference. When did that difference happen? Because a lot of people said, well, look, having a baby especially in the aftermath, it's really demanding. You're sleep deprived, you get woken up all through the night, etc. That's what's making people's brains change. So they wanted to find out whether that was really the case. And so one of their own research team, who was actually going to have IVF, so they knew exactly when she was going to try to get pregnant, they knew when she was pregnant, and then obviously they knew when she'd had the baby. It was the perfect opportunity to study one person multiple times. And they published the results last week in the journal Nature Neuroscience. And what it shows is exactly as other studies had suggested, there is a loss of grey matter from the brain globally during pregnancy.
And you mean literally there, because we say that sort of colloquially, but what do you mean when you say a loss of grey matter, that the brain physically becomes smaller?
Yes, and between 1% and 5% reduction in grey matter, the cells in the brain, the outer rind or cortex of the brain, physically getting thinner over the course of the pregnancy. It wasn't in the aftermath, having had the baby. It happens in a linear way during the progression of the pregnancy. And so this shows you that it is not just the sleep deprivation. This is some kind of adaptive change that happens, and it appears to be locked in. It's a sort of baked-in change, because it doesn't recover afterwards. There is a loss of perhaps, as I say, up to 5% in some parts of the brain of the grey matter. These are the nerve cells in the brain. So you
and
might
that
say,
doesn't
well,
regenerate.
Yeah, it doesn't come back. The one thing about the central nervous system is it doesn't regenerate. If you injure your brain, you may adapt to that injury, but you don't get new brain tissue. So why is this happening is the question. And I spoke to her and I said, well, why do you think this is happening? And they're speculating that this represents a remodeling of the brain under the influence of the hormones that become much, much greater in level during pregnancy. These hormones seem to be triggering certain parts of the brain to adjust their connectivity, and specifically the way that one nerve cell talks to another. And some of this volume loss, which is compensated by an increase in the amount of fluid in the brain, this appears to be because some nerve cells are talking to each other a bit less. It's like your brain is honing the connections between one region and another. So then you ask the question, well what regions are being honed? Regions are being more richly connected?
Right. Well, and also the question I'm asking is well, what's the purpose of it? If we were designed this way, if we've evolved this way, then what's the benefit?
And the regions of the brain that are being honed seem to be those concerned with emotional processing, attachment, having relationships with others, and perhaps in the case of a mother, mother-baby bonding. So what we think is happening is that under the influence of intense hormone fluxes, you remodel your brain to make you better able to cope with the demands of motherhood and forming the attachment to a newborn baby. Now, the question they can't answer yet is, well, if I have 15 kids, does this mean my brain shrinks with every pregnancy? Or does this happen once and then you're set for life in terms of how your brain is remodeled?
So
or
we,
is there
yeah.
a change with yeah. every pregnancy? So we need to now do the study on women who are having 15 kids.
Or a study on the same woman who, if she goes on to have another child.
Exactly right. That's what I'm getting at. I'm being slightly facetious, but yes, absolutely. Does it change incrementally with each child? One would speculate that there will be some changes, but probably not as dramatic as the first. This rewriting of brain connections is almost certainly impacted by female hormones that change during pregnancy, and they're probably changing the connection map in the brain. And once you've rewritten your connection map to an extent, there wouldn't be much to be gained by doing that more. But obviously, we'd need to do that study, and I suspect that that's next on their wish list.
Well, I suppose if I was a young woman considering, you know, whether to have children or not and so on, and then, I mean, this is something that you'd... This is, I won't say put you off, but it goes on quite a long list of the downsides, if you like. You know, if we're saying, well, you know, you have children, you're gonna literally physically lose grey matter. You know, it's quite
well,
a big
does
thing.
It? Because one thing you could say is, well, as a baby, a newborn baby has many more connections in its brain than a child that's 10. When we're born, our brain's got about 100 billion nerve cells in it. Each one's making up to 5-10,000 connections to other nerve cells. But the connections are a bit loose and woolly. They're all over the place. Everything's connected to everything else. And as we learn, although we have this view that learning involves making connections between brain areas, although that does happen, we strengthen the connections between one area and another. What actually we do to a greater extent is we sever connections. We prune them away to make us better at doing certain things. And you can think of it like, it's like picking up a sharper and sharper tool or a finer and finer pencil. If you're drawing with a big fat crayon, you get a very rough image. But if you're drawing with a really fine, sharp pencil, you get a really fine, very delicate image that you draw. And as the brain hones in on the connections it does want and gets rid of the ones it doesn't want, your neurological function becomes much more tightly focused and honed to produce a much better outcome. And so this could be honing the circuits that are concerned with social behaviour. Yes, you're changing your brain, but you're changing your brain not in a negative way, but in a positive, beneficial way. And everybody's brain changes with every day of our lives. The brain you go to bed with tonight is different than the brain you got up with this morning, it's famously said, because your experiences change the way your brain forms and the way your brain works. We are continuously learning throughout life. So this isn't necessarily a negative. And the one other important thing about this is that although the names makes it sound trivial, baby blues, postnatal depression is a big problem for a significant number of people who have children. We don't really understand why people get this, in some cases, really serious depression. And also other psychiatric conditions become much more common in the aftermath of pregnancy. It could be that some of these changes that they're seeing are either over-exuberant in some people or under-exuberant in some people, and that's why they're at risk of developing these psychiatric problems. If we can understand what they're doing, how they're doing it, and to what extent they're doing it right and doing it wrong, we're in a position to help people either to reduce their risk of getting one of these conditions or to help them so that if they do develop one of these conditions, we can be ready for it, prepare them for it, and minimise the impact on them.
But so why hasn't there been more neurological research, MRI scans and all the rest of it done here? Why isn't that funded? There would seem to be an obvious win when you see it in the context of the, you know, the vast amount of suffering that postnatal depression causes.
Have you had an MRI scan, Adrian?
I have, yes, on various parts of my
anatomy. So you can describe very well for the audience what it's like to climb into, effectively,
it's like climbing inside an
oil drum and someone banging on the outside with a sledgehammer, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an unpleasant experience to go through all these scans, and B, we were quite cautious until recently about putting a woman who's pregnant in a scanner because we weren't convinced about the safety until someone had done it enough to convince us that there is no evidence of harm. And now we do this more. So it's not a problem having an MRI in pregnancy, but when you've got a perfectly healthy person and you're saying, and we want to subject you to serial MRIs in pregnancy, which might be stressful, it might be, you can see why people would be cautious about taking a perfectly healthy person and subjecting them to scans they might benefit from by zero amount. So as a result, these things have not been done, except in very limited circumstances. Now we're beginning to do them, and so this sort of corpus of knowledge is going to grow from this point, I would think. But it's still not a very pleasant experience having an MRI, especially for people who don't like confined spaces.
OK, let's move on to the resurrection of seeds. What can you tell us about seed resurrection, Chris?
Well, about 20 years ago, I met this woman after I read a paper and I said, this is amazing. And Sarah Sallon, who's a researcher in Israel, had published this paper almost 20 years ago where she had grown the seeds of dates that were recovered, the stones of dates that were recovered from archaeological sites in the Middle East, and produced these date palms, which were unique in their era because they had not grown for thousands of years. And so I've kept in touch with what she's been up to. And I saw this paper coming through the other day, and she's done it again, but not with dates this time. She has gone or went to some archaeologists at the university and said, can I have a look through your stuff? And found in some archaeological remains a seed which had come from a cave in Judea, and she was able to get them to give her this seed, and her colleague Elaine grew the seed, and it has turned into a tree. And this tree they have christened, if that's the right word to use in Israel, Sheba. And the tree looks like, having they've sent samples of the tree's leaves to people all around the world who are experts on this particular group of plants, and a lady in America worked out what this was and said it's a Communifera, which is the myrrh and frankincense family. And these particular ones, this doesn't look like anything that's growing on Earth today. They, when the seed grew, got the seed case, sent it to Switzerland, got them to carbon date it, and it turns out the seed was at least 1,000 years old from this cave in Judea and has now germinated into this plant. So what they think they might have is either an extinct species, which used to grow across that part of the Middle East and no longer does, or is somewhere lurking out there in nature in a low level and has yet to be discovered and described by science. But because it's in this myrrh family, myrrh has enormous biblical relevance. And as Sarah told me, there is quite a tantalising story in the Old Testament. If you look at Genesis, where Jacob, of Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat fame, says he gives his sons some material to give to Pharaoh as a gift, and the gift he gives them is this resinaceous material, apparently, and it's supposed to come from possibly a myrrh tree, but no one really knew what this was or where it had come from and what this possible source was. So what she speculates tantalizingly is they have found the tree that would have been the source of this resinaceous material which Jacob sent to Pharaoh as a gift, and having sent samples from their tree, which is now about twice as high as she is, to various laboratories around the world, including Australia, they have shown there are enormous numbers of medicinally relevant chemicals in this resin that oozes out of the bark of this tree. So they think they have an amazing archaeological story with a biblical spin-off.
Oh, it's extraordinary work, and Dr. Sarah Salant joins us now. I don't know where to start with this. I mean, what, to actually get the seed to germinate, what did you have to do? Just talk to it very persuavingly, or what?
No. First of all, let me be clear. I got the seed from the Hebrew University, which they, you know, excavated it about 40 years ago. And I chose it from a sort of a little batch of seeds that they found in this cave. And then I took that seed, one that was in very good condition, and I gave it to my colleague, Dr. Soloway, who is a master expert on arid plants.
Okay, listen, I just have to hang on. I just have to ask you to just get back in your car. Don't drive it, but just because the wind is making it impossible to.
I'll get back in the car.
Okay.
I got out the car because I thought you might be better to go in. I'll get back into the car.
It feels a long way from the 7th and 8th centuries BCE, doesn't
yeah.
it? But, okay, you're there now. Okay.
No, hang on a second. Turn the engine off. Turn it off the engine.
Okay.
All right, okay. So, listen, we're in a place that's not a great place to talk.
Okay.
But I gave the seed to my colleague, Dr. Soloway, on Kibbutz Keturah, and she managed to germinate it. So it was, you know, this was a remarkable thing. She specialises in this family of plants particularly. So
but how do you get it to germinate? How do you get it to germinate? What can you do other than just...
She soaked it in water for about 12 hours, and then she added some basic fertilisers, K1 and a rooting hormone that farmers use basically to wake up, you know, dormant seeds. Nothing very exciting, just some standard fertilizer and hormonal solutions for about 24 hours. And then she planted it in fresh potting soil. And lo and behold, 5 weeks later, we had a plant.
And what are the... What's the implications for what you've achieved here in terms of science? You know, what else can we bring back from a long time ago?
You know, Matt, we're not the first people to germinate these ancient seeds, and there's a lot of interest now in what they call resurrection genomics, which is trying to bring back ancient seeds from archaeological sites, because you can replant them and re-establish ancient flora that was once here, and you can study their genomes, and it's remarkable the number of things you can do with these ancient seeds. I mean, lots and lots of species have disappeared from the earth in the last 1,000, 2,000 years, and if we can bring some of them back, it's remarkable, especially ones like, for example, our date seeds, which are very important cultivars. You know, you can reintroduce lost species, and perhaps with their genetic material, improve present species. There's lots and lots of things to do.
So, what's your next seed? If where are you moving on to?
We haven't got a next seed at the moment. We're looking at the resin of Sheba to see what medicinal activity it has, because the researchers at the University of Strasbourg, Professors Philippe Schaeffer and Pierre Adam, are very keen to investigate this very, very large molecule, or this large compound that they discovered in the resin, and to investigate it further. You know, to see what sort of bioactivity it has. It hasn't been described before, this compound, so they're very excited about that. We'll wait and see. You know, the Sheba, if we think it was a biblical species that's mentioned in Genesis and mentioned by the prophets, that grew in Gilead, then it was connected with healing. So it would be very interesting to see exactly what kind of healing the resin of Sheba is capable of.
So would this tree, which will now presumably grow, will that have any relatives? Will it have any similarities to any trees currently growing?
Well, it's part of the family of Berceraceae and of the genus Commiphora, which is the resin-bearing trees. You know, that was named by Linnaeus 200 years ago. And in this genus Commiphora, there's about 200 species. So Professor Weeks, Andrea, the lady in the States who did the genetics, said that from her testing of about 109 of these species of Commiphora, it was unique. It had a unique genetic fingerprint. But we don't know if it doesn't actually exist somewhere else, because she's only tested about half of the Commiphora. So maybe it survives somewhere else, perhaps in Africa, where a lot of these Commiphora grow, or in Arabia, where many of them are found. None of them are found now in the Middle East as we know it, and certainly not in this area, not now. But 1,000 years ago, there were probably some relics. And in the Bronze Age, you know, 1,800 BCE, when the Genesis story takes place, there were probably a lot of them in the area of Gilead, which is present-day Jordan, the east bank of the Jordan. So, you know, we don't know if it's unique, but it's got a unique fingerprint according to what's been tested so far.
Sarah, do you know if it's a male or a female, your tree? Can Sheba breed? And can you cross it with one of these that's around at the moment? Or can you take cuttings? Yeah, how are you going to propagate it?
All right, so propagating the Commiphora is often done by cuttings. You cut off a branch or twig and you plant it in the earth and it grows. In antiquity, the ancients basically said the famous Judean balsam, which we don't think this is because it's not fragrant, but the fragrant Judean balsam, which probably came from Arabia, was always propagated from cuttings. Now, we've made some cuttings of Sheba, of course. At the present moment, it hasn't produced any flowers and therefore any fruit or seed. And we really don't know about whether it's male or female.
It's amazing that this seed has sat there in a cave for 1,000 years and still came to life relatively quickly? I just think that's amazing.
Well, I think it's amazing. And in the same cave, we also discovered a date seed. We called her Hannah. And she's one of our 2,000-year-old date seeds that also came to life.
Yeah.
So even older than Sheba is Hannah, who's also growing now at Kibbutz Keturah in the south of Israel.
Okay.
Where I'm currently on the way to.
All right. Have a good trip. Thank you very much. That's Dr. Sarah Salen. And lovely to be back on air with Dr. Chris Smith and Naked Scientist as well. And with that, we'll go from ancient seeds to the thriving floribunda that is the Labour Party conference. And Matt Chorley is there. How far are we away from the leader's speech, Matt?
We think minutes away. We're told it's going to start very imminently. Welcome back to Liverpool. Thanks very much, Adrian. We are counted down to, Keir Starmer's big first conference speech since winning the general election, the first Labour leader to address the party's Prime Minister for 15 years. Matt Chorley coming to you live from the Labour conference in Liverpool. I'm joined by an expert panel to analyse the speech when he's delivered it. I'm joined by Times columnist and author Patrick McGuire. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Matt.
Katie Ball's been kind of the spectators here as well.
Hello.
In a sentence, what does Keir Starmer need to do, do you think, Patrick?
That's a very, you know, Matt, having read my work for a long time, that I struggle to express any sentiment in a sentence. Mm. But I think he needs to show that better times are ahead, that this government deals more in doom and gloom. That's a sentence, probably with a couple of semicolons, but hopefully it does the job.
Katie, same questions to you.
Yeah, I think he needs to show that he has a purpose and also a plan, because it's felt a little bit loose recently. So I think it's a good opportunity to put a few difficult weeks behind him if he can.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make. The past couple of weeks and even this conference have been dominated by rows over the axing of the winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners, taking freebies from donors, how much Sue Gray's paid. In a way, Patrick, it feels like that's been allowed to dominate in the absence of sort of proactive news generation by the government.
Well, it's an interesting question, which I put to a cabinet minister a couple of days ago. It was, what would we be talking about right now if the freebie story didn't exist, if there was no division or no reports of division in Downing Street, if we weren't banging on about Sue Gray? And I think cabinet ministers themselves would admit, actually, it's quite hard to discern what the answer would be. Because we're waiting for the budget next month, where, let's be honest, lots of the politics of the next year will be set. And so Keir Starmer has to show that this is government with direction, that he has things to say, because otherwise this has all been a nice talking shop for people in the Labour Party to pat themselves on the back, but it has left us none the wiser about what they're actually going to do in government.
For a party that prided itself, Katie, on being the most ready government ever, the most planning, we've got Sue Gray who knows how government works. Now they keep telling us, look, we've only been in government for a few weeks, it's teething problems, they're still learning the ropes. And if you look at the opinion polls, it suggests that the public aren't as willing to give the benefit of the doubt as perhaps the government hopes.
Yeah, I think I think they're realising the difficulties from going from opposition to government, and sometimes it feels as though they still have the opposition approach, partly because they've been there for so long. And that means that, if you're in government, you can just make an announcement and everyone is going to follow it because you are the government. But yet, they seem to be not really going forward. And, they used to, over the recess, have, really active grids to try and get one over on the Tories. But now they're in government, it feels as though they've stopped doing that. Mm. At actually a time when it would be the right thing to do, because when Labour politicians say, oh, you're all so trivial as journalists, personality politics, to Patrick's point, give journalists some other things to work with. Otherwise, what tends to happen is the narrative slips away from you to back onto the media's territory.
And also, as Matt, we're not making this up. We do have some sense of professional pride. We'd love to be talking about lofty things and weighty policy proposals.
Yeah, a huffing great big new news story, a policy or something.
Yeah,
would,
about the direction of the country.
Good afternoon. If you are just joining us, it's just, 2 minutes past two here on 5 Live. It's Matt Chorley coming to you live from the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. We'll bring you Keir Starmer's speech in full in just a moment, just as soon as it's... You'll be astonished to hear, much like last week with Ed Davey, we were promised a 2 o'clock prompt start, and they haven't started yet.
We'll be deciding.